The time is now 8 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Locus Focus Talk Radio with Barbara Bernstein and her guest, author Rob Johnson, for a look at executive bonuses and corporate greed.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call-in talk radio, where the time is almost 2 minutes after 8 o'clock. And the number to call to join the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, in the past week, there's been an intense outrage over AIG executive bonuses and other manifestations of corporate greed. This morning, we're going to talk about how we get beyond the angry mob mentality, so put down your pitchforks, with our guest Rob Johnson, formerly a managing director of Soros Funds Management and a chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee. He co-wrote an article that's coming out called Too Big to Bail, The Balson Put, Presidential Politics, and the Global Financial Meltdown. Rob is with us to provide a better context for understanding the current financial crisis than the kind of knee-jerk responses that currently rule in the mass media. Rob Johnson, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning.
So do you think it's time for us to put down our pitchforks and start really looking around at what's going on?
Well, I think I listened to your introduction, and I want to be very careful here. I think a lot of the rage is valid. I think the population's anger is justified, and I think attempts to discuss them, as the administration and others have done, as being kooky or deranged is quite harmful at this time, because I think the administration and the previous administration have done great harm to the U.S. taxpayer, and the financiers have done great harm, and the public is quite valid to be very angry with them now and very angry about the proposed solutions.
Well, actually, it seems to me, I mean, I've been seeing ranging from John Stewart, who's actually been pretty funny. He has an angry mob that runs across the bottom of the screen almost every night. And I think that he's actually making fun of the mainstream media's portrayal of the anger. But I think that it's important to distinguish between the justifiable anger, which I think a lot of people feel, and then some of the anger, which I think is being fomented more by the right, which is a very different kind. That's the angry mob that I'm thinking of with a pitchfork. So how would you distinguish between what's really justifiable anger and what's maybe manufactured anger to undo whatever possible progressive things this current administration might be trying to do?
Well, I think you point to a very important, what I'll call, fork in the road, because populist rage, which is designed to dissuade people from feeling that the government can do any good, leads to, in essence, no progress, and it leads to perhaps, like we saw in Europe in the 1930s, a more authoritarian solution to reimpose order when, in essence, no progress is made. On the other hand, I do think, as I said in my opening comments, that the administration is running a real risk now by trying to play too much inside baseball with the top Wall Street people, and how do I say, not solving the problems and handing a big bill to the taxpayer, and they are at some level deserving of their reputation.
So let's talk a little bit about the AIG bailout, and do you think that bailout was necessary? I know that in the article that you are coming out with Too Big to Bail, that you're also suggesting perhaps that when a company is too big to fail, it's too big to exist?
Well, at some level, you need to have a system under a market-based system where failures can be resolved. Bankruptcy can take place, restructuring can take place, and the administration, at least as I read the press reports, seems to be pleading that the world would crash if Citibank or AIG or whatever were definitively put through those restructuring processes. So the alternative is for the taxpayers to put hundreds of billions of dollars into their pockets, and in essence, they're being rewarded, and their counterparties like Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and others are being rewarded for having taken the economy hostage. That's not a tenable or sustainable structure for a society to run on in the long term. Not at all.
So what would you see as the alternative to, first of all, I mean, when Merrill Lynch was bought out and when Bear Stearns failed, the economy, well, I'm not sure the economy tanked, Wall Street tanked, everybody panicked, and that was basically the same scenario that's being projected if AIG failed. Do you think that there was a connection between the Wall Street demise around Bear Stearns, problems with Merrill Lynch, and that if AIG had just been allowed to go to file bankruptcy, if things would be even worse now than they are?
Well, I think there are different dimensions to this. First of all, the chapter in this unfolding that people cite as being the crisis was the failure of Lehman Brothers. And at that time, many, many investors have stock in banks or hold bonds in banks, you know, banks' liabilities. And then there are, of course, depositors. And everybody knew depositors were guaranteed and everybody knew stockholders were at risk. But the bondholders didn't know whether they were guaranteed or not. Legally, they're not. But the conjecture, the wink and the nod from the authorities has always been that they would be taken care of. When Lehman went bust, Hank Paulson essentially decided he had to pull the plug and show that they could be tough, and it shocked and surprised everybody. Now, you take that lesson and you say, we can't do it again with Lehman Brothers or Citibank. I absolutely disagree with that. I believe you could do an orderly wind down by putting these companies into like an FDIC restructuring program in the case of a bank, or Chapter 11 in the case of an insurance company under current law, and have an orderly wind down, make the counterparties, as I mentioned, the Goldman Sachs and Bank of America's and others, take some kind of hit in the losses associated with the bankrupting of AIG, and we could work that out. And I think that they're using the Lehman Brothers episode to scare everybody from doing things that essentially would cost the stockholders of big financial institutions a lot of money. And I don't think that fear is justified.
So, the problem seems to be that the people who have all the money don't want to have to lose any money. Meanwhile, the rest of us are really losing everything. How do we make that case to the Obama administration so maybe they see things a little differently than the way that Obama presented it yesterday?
Well, I think they got to start being afraid of the population. I don't mean, you know, violence and guns. I mean in the voting booth. I think organization, I think demonstration. Yesterday's program, the public-private investment, or I guess it was Monday's program, which caused the stock market to go up 7%, is being celebrated in the major media. What they're not saying is that 7% of stock market value came right out of the taxpayer's pocket. It was a direct transfer. And they're using, to back up just for a second, we have problems in our financial sector that are now abundantly obvious. They use too much leverage, too many opaque and complex products, and the incentives of managers, meaning the financial executives, were quite perverse. It was heads they win, tails the taxpayer loses. Now the government's building a program with this PPIF, and what's going on with that? They're using lots of leverage. It's a complex and opaque program that's hammering the taxpayer. And the government's financial structure is starting to look levered, complex, and with, and who knows what kind of incentive political leaders have. We're now in a place where we're replicating the illness that the private sector exhibited over the last 5 years on the government's balance sheet. And we are not restructuring things in a way where, as we've talked about earlier in this program, you would break up the large institutions so no one is too big to resolve and no one is too big to fail going forward.
Well, there was a call a couple weeks ago, actually a month ago, for the nationalization of the banks, and it was coming from very surprising quarters, like from Republicans like John McCain. What are your thoughts about, instead of the direction that we're going, where this is private-public partnership, that we actually went ahead and nationalized the banks and companies like AIG, and what are the pitfalls of the proposals being made by people like John McCain?
Well, first of all, this idea of nationalization was a little bit of PR spin. It invokes the specter of, you know, Che Guevara coming out of the hills and socializing the means of production. What we really are talking about is restructuring through a bankruptcy or bankruptcy-like process at the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and putting these things back out into the private sector after a short to medium length of time, roughly 2 to 5 years. I don't see anything wrong with that, and I don't see anything wrong given that the taxpayer is paying for the bailout, filling the hole, that the taxpayer becomes the stockholder and captures the upside coming out of the hole. I see absolutely nothing wrong with that. With your question regard to John McCain and other Republicans, there has been some concern that large private equity funds, Carlyle Group, Kohlberg, Caravis, Roberts, KKR, they call it, and others, Blackstone and these others, would like to own banks. And these are very conservative, very politically powerful businesses that would like to own banks, and they would like to restructure the rules of future regulation to make their acquisitions profitable. So in my view, while I saw the Alan Greenspans and McCains and Lindsey Grahams and others favoring nationalization, I would say to the American public, we have to make the rules about what the future financial structure and institutions can look like to safeguard the citizens before we let anybody buy anything. You don't want these people buying them and then using their lobbying power to make the rules and put us, what you might call, back into another crisis in 5 or 10 years.
Well, I'm talking with Rob Johnson, who is formerly with Soros, banking, but the Soros Funds Management, and a chief economist for the Senate Banking Committee. And he recently wrote or co-wrote an article called Too Big to Bail, The Boston Put, Presidential Politics and the Global Financial Meltdown, which is coming out soon. And remind me which publication, the Financial. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I
okay.
am.
Okay, I forget which the publication that your article is coming out in soon.
It's the International Journal of Political Economy.
Right, and then there's kind of a preview to that last month in The Nation, where you talked about nationalizing failing banks.
Right.
If you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187, and it's about 13 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Well, in the nationalization program, there's this thing called the bad bank, where you put all these toxic assets, and I've read, like, on the from different progressive economists, both like good things and bad things about the bad bank. And I wonder if you can explain what the bad bank would do and perhaps some of the problems with the bad bank.
Well, the bad bank is a like a super fund, using an environmental metaphor, where the toxic assets are placed. The good thing about the bad bank is that the assets are separated from the good bank. And as a result, people can look at the good bank, credit can flow, and people can have confidence that the resulting good bank is sound, well-capitalized, and they understand the balance sheet. In other words, they understand how to analyze on an ongoing basis that the good bank is clean and safe to do business with. That promotes a resumption of the credit allocation process that was what you might call performing fine until late fall of 2007. The problems with the bad bank become, it is a government institution that has to sell off, in this case, probably $1 trillion to $4 trillion worth of assets. And as William Seidman, who ran the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the bad bank at the time of the savings and loan bailout, has said, put $1 trillion on the table and you'd be surprised how many bad people show up and want to do things with it. And what I mean there is the sale of those assets and the pricing of the sale of those assets is a process that has to be done with great care and great transparency. As my former boss, William Proxmire, used to say, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And you have to put floodlights on the process of disposing of assets from a bad bank to make sure that the taxpayer gets reasonable value.
So how different is this plan from what looks like the Obama administration is proposing?
It's quite different because the good bank, bad bank split involved, as you referred to it, nationalizing or restructuring where the existing equity holders would be zeroed out and the new capital, therefore the new equity shares, would have been held by the taxpayer as the taxpayer paid for the losses associated with the toxic assets. Under the current circumstance, the taxpayer is guaranteeing the losses so that the private sector, hedge funds and investment funds, can take the upside. Bank stockholders are not removed from their stockholdings. They're not zeroed out. But if everything falls back down, meaning asset prices deteriorate, it all falls back to the taxpayer. So the taxpayer gets the downside, and the bank stockholders, hedge funds, and private equity guys get the upside. What I will call that in a cynical term is donor heaven. And what I mean by that is the political donors who back both parties largely come from the financial sector, including hedge funds, private equity funds, and large financial institutions, the brand names you know, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, Goldman Sachs.
And that's why the stock market did so well on Monday, because these people were relieved that nationalization of the banks wasn't going to happen.
Right. The banking index was up about 17%. And what they're basically saying is, wahoo, Secretary Geithner stiffed the taxpayer and bailed us out.
Now, one of the ironies about this is that it's in some way, I mean, the people who had the biggest advantage of this are, of course, the big financial guys. But I know that a lot of mutual funds that are done, you know, that are invested responsibly in socially responsible investments, that they were very heavy in financial stocks because, I guess, at least according to one financial advisor I talked to, those were seen as being more socially responsible than, of course, like oil and Halliburton and companies like that. So a lot of people who had their mutual funds invested in these socially responsible funds actually took a big hit when the financial market crashed. And so how do you, at the same time that you want to basically make the financial elite take responsibility for the what they've created and have them take a hit, how do you keep just smaller investors who are investing in socially responsible mutual funds from also taking a hit?
I don't think that that's the nature of a market system, that we have to insure everybody from taking a hit. Otherwise, prices don't mean anything. And I am not a what you might call free market fundamentalist by any means. But in essence, the people who bought financial institutions that were massively leveraged, and Goldman Sachs or Citibank's leverage of 33 or 42 to 1 was public information. It was in the annual reports and the quarterly reports called 10Q. If those asset managers were buying those under-regulated, opaque, highly leveraged institutions and they lost money, I can't really feel sorry for them. And I know it's one degree removed when you're a mutual fund holder, you're a small investor, and you got tagged. But that's how the market process has to work. Or we don't have a market process. Secondly, I would much prefer that they let the banks who made this mess go bust, and if they decide they want to do something for the small pension or 401k plans or whatever, then do the direct subsidy to them. There's no reason to be subsidizing them indirectly by protecting banks that have made a mess if your concern is the small investor. Just go take care of the small investor with that money directly. I mean, we're talking about a couple $1 trillion. That would take care of a lot of the problem.
Well, I keep getting this feeling as I've been listening to the Obama people talking about their bailout plan. It feels a little bit like trickle-down economics, the same economic plans that I've heard Obama be very critical of. Do you think there's much difference in the thinking of the current Obama plan, where basically if we save the big financial institutions, it'll help everybody? Or is there much difference between that and Reagan's more overt trickle-down economics?
I think there's almost no difference between the Geithner approach and his predecessor, Hank Paulson, under the Bush administration. What remains in the balance is, well, first of all, what has happened since the Bush administration is they've enacted a stimulus plan, a $750 billion plan over the next 2 years. I don't really think that's a Republican or Democrat thing. What hangs in the balance is future of financial regulation. I believe on Thursday of this week in congressional hearings, Secretary Geithner will trot out the what you might call outline or overarching perspective of a financial regulation plan, and it remains to be seen whether it's more or less healthy than what the market fundamentalists under Bush would have proposed. But in terms of the bailout structure for the banks, the TARP that we learned about in October and this concoction that was revealed this week, there's almost no difference. As a matter of fact, I think it was kind of designed in conjunction with Secretary Geithner when he was the president of the New York Fed last fall.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking with Rob Johnson, who is formerly with the Soros Funds Management and chief economist for the Senate Banking Committee. We're talking this morning about trying to understand what is going on with the bailouts and with the direction that the Obama administration is taking towards trying to solve the great financial dilemma that we're in. And you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. We've got Paul on the line. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning. You're on the air. Well, we had Paul on the line. But
anyway, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Hi.
Okay. I have a couple of questions for your guest because I've been thinking about this for quite a while, and I've been involved in the real estate industry for like 17 years. And I noticed several years ago when we got to the point where wages weren't keeping up with home prices. So the banks started coming up with these instruments that were total nonsense so that people who couldn't afford to buy a house could get into a house, and it was all, the house of cards that we're familiar with. And so I have this couple of points, and I'd like your guest's opinion on here. So it seems to me that unless they do something like raise the minimum wage to $10 or $11 an hour and jack up income to that degree, that there's no way to support, and I'm not even sure at that point that it would, the current housing prices. And so it seems to me that for the economy to get back into a balance, that home prices have to come down quite a bit. Now, does your guest concur with this?
Well, first of all, it has been very clear for more than 20 years that our productivity's been rising, profits been rising, and wages haven't kept up with productivity growth, which is,
yes.
And what we've had accompanying that, because ordinarily you would have thought that would have caused a great sense of what you might call anger in the society, because it would look unfair. But what we've had associated, as you'd rightly describe, is with stagnant incomes, we've had credit innovation. So the same amount of income has allowed more and more and more borrowing, both in the consumer sector and in the residential construction housing sector. That has come to an end, and things have gone into hard reverse. And I think at this juncture, your recommendation of raising the minimum wage, or more generally, raising the purchasing power of the general population, is absolutely necessary to support the current housing stock, and absent that, we're very, very likely to see continued decline in real estate. Perhaps not as violent as we've seen in the previous 18 months, but I wouldn't expect that the washout, meaning the decline in price, is over yet. I do note that yesterday the cloture vote on the Employee Free Choice Act failed. My understanding is Arlen Specter sided with the Republicans. They couldn't get their 60 votes. And as a result, that dimension of strengthening labor negotiating rights will not become part of law in the first year of the Obama administration. I know the labor unions were quite unhappy about that last night.
So did the Democrats pretty much stand together with that? And it was just...
Yes. There was no breaking of ranks, but they just couldn't get their 60 votes. They had thought Arlen Specter or a couple of others were candidates to support it, but the lobbyists on the business side, the Chamber of Commerce and others, prevailed.
So,
okay, actually, Paul, I want to continue on and take some more callers, so thanks for calling.
Well, can I ask you one more question?
Quickly. Okay.
All right. I mean, because it seems to me, and your guests seem to be alluding to this, that, you know, at some point there has to be some accounting for investor risk and they have to suffer the consequences. And the big question that I have is as to why not let this happen is, does he see a major risk of big pension funds failing in a total catastrophic collapse of the economy if we don't let some of these people segment and fail like he was alluding to earlier?
Okay, and thanks a whole lot for calling, Paul.
Well, I think the... what you might say, the wholesale burden of this adjustment plan is really going to fall on future generations, because they're going to debt finance with U.S. federal government debt. It might be something in the neighborhood of $1.8 to $3 trillion, which if you have $3 trillion of additional debt, you've got to pay the interest on that debt. That's probably $120 billion a year. $120 billion a year would pay for single-payer national health insurance. And I'm not talking about $120 billion one time. I'm saying forever that debt services the cost of the increasing debt. So we're in a situation now where the mistakes that have been made in finance, say, since the year 2000, will cost the American people forever the equivalent of national health insurance. I think this is a profound crisis.
So before we figure, I know that you have to leave pretty soon, but before we figure out how we get out of that crisis, I'm curious also at what you think about the AIG bonuses and how do we get those paid back, and do you think it's really important that we get them paid back?
Well, quantitatively, it is not important. It's less than 0.1% of the AIG bailout, no less the whole bailout. Symbolically, it is very, very important. I was a guest on Bill Moyer's show about 3 weeks ago, and in the cards and letters I got back from that appearance, the most exciting thing people said was that I said the government regulator ought to ask for letters of resignation from all the major financial executives and choose whether or not to accept all of them, because some of these people are very capable. But to symbolically say the government governs the financial sector, not the other way around. And I think the AIG bonus symbolism is a test case of when people cause the problem and the world is suffering, people don't get paid bonuses for it. It's just immoral, unethical, unfair, and the government has to put a little backbone into stopping those practices because they're demoralizing.
Well, one comment that's been made a lot is the idea that the bonuses have to be paid because of contractual agreements, and you can't break the contracts. However, workers all over the country are being required, not just asked, to basically renege on their contracts and give up benefits, pay, hours, whatever. How do we equalize that so that the same standards, the same requests or requirements being made of all working people in this country are also being required of banking executives and insurance executives like the AIG executives?
Well, I thought that former Treasury Secretary Summers' comments about the sanctity of contracts was rather hollow, and it might be because I grew up in Detroit and all my friends there are restructuring their lives, as you mentioned. I think it is important to recognize that, Tom Johagen has just written a beautiful piece in Harper's Magazine about how workers' rights are not enforced, workers' pension rights are not enforced, and in credit cards, usury limits have been repealed, and essentially we're having a society of by and for the financial sector. And it's really quite a devastating long, it's the cover story of the current Harper's Magazine. And Tom is a labor lawyer based in Chicago. We do have selective enforcement of rights based on what you might call a system of power that has nothing to do with the logic of contracts.
Well, in the last few moments that you're with us, Robert Johnson, could you give us a little bit of hope? Maybe what do you think are the possible inroads with the Obama administration to help push them in a different direction than they're going right now?
I think, unfortunately, on one level, the fear of the right-wing populism, because people become cynical about them, is very dangerous for them. And so at some level, that may cause them to do things that are more ethical, kind of heading off at the pass, outrage that would turn people back towards the Republicans. I think the biggest danger here is that when Franklin Roosevelt was president, he did things with the government that made people feel that the government could positively affect their lives. And I'm looking at opinion polls. I'm looking at a study from Chicago Business School by a man named Luigi Zingales, that trust is deteriorating. And as these polls are done with thousands of people sampled, they're finding that trust in the financial sector is down, trust in the stock market is down, but actually trust in government officials is going down very fast at the same time. And when they ask those who have lost confidence in the financial sector why, about 85% of those people have responded positively to the question, is the government taking better care of Goldman Sachs than it's taking care of the taxpayer it represents? And people do not feel that the government's doing the right thing. So I think outrage from economists, I think outrage from media organs, I think people demonstrating, people in a peaceful way, but getting out and demonstrating, not being deterred by, quote, expertise or complexity, not being deterred by people calling you names like rabid populists, and persevering and politically organizing is really the only path at this point.
Well, do you think that the outrage over the AIG bonuses is an important factor in maybe starting to turn things around?
I think it's a wake-up call for the inside the Beltway types in Washington. I would refer you to William Grider, who writes for The Nation and has a new book now called Come Home America, wrote a wonderful op-ed piece last Sunday in the Washington Post. And he said, Obama asked us all to stop being apathetic, to reengage, and to believe in politics. And now he has no right to complain about what he's getting, meaning this populist anger that rose up around AIG. It is my hope that people continue to be hopeful for his possibilities. But it reminds me of the old days of Lyndon Johnson, or before that, Franklin Roosevelt. When progressive people would come in and meet with him, he would say privately, Lyndon Johnson I'm referring to, I agree with you. Now go out there and make me do what I should do. And I think Obama cannot be castigated by the public because he doesn't do what they want. They have to go out and make him do what he should do. And he'd probably be grateful for that in the end, even though it makes it more difficult and more tense in the short run.
Well, I've been talking with Robert Johnson, who is the author of an article definitely worth reading called Too Big to Bail, The Paulson Put, Presidential Politics and the Global Financial Meltdown. Also, we have a link to his article last month in The Nation, Nationalized Failing Banks, Think Twice, that he co-wrote with Thomas Ferguson. And we'll have some more information on the website about how you can find out more about this whole concept of what the dangers we're in when we have financial organizations that are too large to fail. So thanks very much for joining us, Robert Johnson.
My pleasure.
And thank you. And we're going to continue now with your phone calls. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. I guess our phone calls all dissipated, so I'm on my own now for the next 25 minutes. But He mentioned an article by William Grider, or a book coming out by William Grider, and also an op-ed piece. And I happened to have pulled out this article by Grider yesterday that was in the Nation, on the Nation's website, and it's called Obama's New Monopoly Set. And it's a very cynical article, but I thought I'd read it just to raise your hackles a bit. And I think that it gives us a sense of what, how much we have to push on the Obama administration, because some of the things that are going on, which seem to have just leapfrogged over the Bush administration and come right out of the Clinton administration, which was the time when sort of the setting and the mechanisms for the problems that we're having now were all being created. So I think it's kind of interesting. So I'll read from this, and again, you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. And we're talking this morning about the aftermath of the AIG bailout, aftermath of the AIG bonuses coming out of the incredible amount of money that the AIG got from the government, and the public outrage over that, and how do we sort through the kinds of right-wing posturing and kind of anti-government posturing that we've also seen erupt from the need to righteous anger at the hypocrisy and the outrageousness of these people who think that they basically can be on the government dole and do whatever they want and live, you know, well, for instance, they, you know, have these incredible junkets and all these other expense-paid vacations, so-called conferences and retreats that they're all doing with the bailout money that they receive from us, the taxpayers. So this is an article by William Grider on the Nation website this week, Obama's New Monopoly Set. President Obama has invented a new board game for Wall Street money guys to play that promises to be a lot of fun. It's very much like the regular Monopoly game that kids play, only better because this one uses real money, provided courtesy of the taxpayers. The best thing about Obama's game is nobody loses. Usually the winner of Monopoly is the one who winds up with the most money. In the Obama version, the losers get any losses back from the government at the end of the game, the president has promised. The guy is a genius. He located these two whiz kids, Tim and Larry, who are smarter than God about financial matters. President Obama commanded the advisors to solve the financial mess, raise the zombie banks from the dead, and start the good times rolling again. This game is what they came up with. It's a very complicated game, and not everyone can understand it. But the Wall Street titans smell hope, for this Monopoly set has no go-to-jail card in the deck. It starts like the real Monopoly game. The president hands out tall stacks of cash to all the players, hedge funds, insurance companies, big-time investors, any well-heeled capitalist with a serious taste for acquiring greater wealth. The players then roll the dice and move their little titan icons around the Monopoly board. They can buy up properties wherever they land, sort of like landing on Boardwalk and Park Place. Only in this case, the properties are the nearly worthless financial assets held by the country's leading banks, like the mortgage-backed securities now known as toxic assets. Banks are glad to be rid of their rotten stuff and will begin to feel better about lending again to the commoners. The titans accumulate a stack of property cards and sell them off to other players at extraordinary profits. At least this is what Tim Geithner and Larry Summers told the president to expect, and he believed them. Before you know it, everyone will start feeling better about themselves. The once worthless financial paper that no one would buy will begin glowing with rising value. Now wealthier titans and much relief bankers will buy more cars and houses, hire more gardeners, more jobs, more hope. Everything starts rolling toward national recovery. Everyone is a winner, even the losers. And I'll continue reading this article in a little bit. This is by William Geithner called Obama's New Monopoly Set. But we got some callers, and you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. And it's about 23 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. I do believe we have a caller on the line as soon as Steve, my engineer, gets off talking to somebody else and can put that caller on the line. So hang on there a moment. Okay, I think we're getting it. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I'd just like to touch on something that maybe I might not get an answer from. But my wife and I both have life insurance with AIG. And I'm kind of curious as if something to happen to one of us, would my life insurance policy even be any good?
Well, yeah, I wish that we still had Bob Johnson on with us, because he probably would know more about this than I do. It's a good question. I think that AIG has a whole lot of different parts to the company, and it was the the part of it that was trading in these mortgage-based securities and these what became toxic assets, that's the part of AIG that's actually kind of crumbling. And people like Robert Johnson and others have called for that part of AIG to be separated from the rest of the company, which is actually a healthy company, pull that out and put that basically into receivership and become and the government would run it, and basically you could throw out all the bums. So I have a feeling probably your they can still pay your insurance right now, but I think it would depend on what comes out in the long term. And I mean, who knows if this very toxic part of AIG would take the rest of the company down.
Yeah, and that's my concern with this is, you know, should I keep paying into this because I get such a great rate for my for the amount of policy coverage that I have that I can't get it anywhere else for that kind of coverage. And so I'm concerned as, you know, and then the other part, of course, is the moral part. Do I want to keep paying these crooks?
Right. You know, I had an interesting kind of similar dilemma. I decided to get life insurance a few months ago, and I made sure, actually, that I was not getting it with AIG. And the person who hooked me up with the insurance was, he's a pretty cool guy, and he was very careful about, you know, the bank, the insurance company that he chose. And in fact, I was fortunate because this was like very shortly after AIG was about to go bust and was getting all that bailout money. So that was like three letters that definitely resonated in my mind when I was looking around for insurance companies. I think for anybody who's shopping for insurance now, probably it would be a very good idea to stay away from AIG. But the other question is how many other insurance companies are also going to be affected, because everybody basically holds debt with everybody else. And it's a very convoluted system, and that's one of the reasons why AIG was considered too big to fail, because basically their debt is being held by all these banks that you and I probably bet. Well, maybe actually my bank doesn't. I belong to a credit union, thank God. So it's not part of this whole financial mess. But if you bank with any commercial bank, it is probably all completely messed up with the AIG debacle as well. And so that's part of the problem, is that it's very hard to trace where your money goes and where, you know, where it comes out the other end.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for your insight there. I appreciate it, Barbara.
Sure. Thanks for calling. Okay. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 19 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. And I was reading an article by William Grider, and I'll finish this article off. But please feel free to call, because the rest of this half hour is for you to call and express yourselves and what your concerns are. I just want to finish this article. He continues to say this is a monopoly game for adults. Only adults are allowed to play this game. It is much too complicated for ordinary citizens, so sophisticated financiers are needed to do such tricky deals. The Americans at large can have fun watching the action and rooting for various participants. The contest will be a welcome distraction from other anxieties. Who's going to accumulate the tallest stack? It's like Monopoly Olympics for the grandmasters of the universe. Will Warren Buffett take a seat at the table? Bill Gross, the PIMCO bond king, is salivating at the prospects of double-digit returns and says Obama's game is win-win-win. Can billionaire George Soros resist such an opportunity? Will legendary traders at Goldman Sachs score up against James A. Baker III's Carlyle Group with his oil-rich Arab backers? What a kick that these famous people will be playing with our money. But remember, this is not about a few shrewd players accumulating more wealth. It's about saving the country. Everybody will want to do their part. Obama has shown them the way. Probably there are some naysayers in the public who won't get it. They will whine about the odd ways in which the winners always seem to get another chance in U.S. capitalism to win again. Some people will look around them and complain that things do not seem to be improving in their neighborhood. They will attack our president personally, try to undermine his authority. President Obama can charm them out of their anger. He might say, hey, guys, lighten up. It's only a game. Well, that's a pretty cynical view on what's going on, but I do think it kind of raises some very interesting points. And you can join the conversation by calling right now at 503-231-8187. We got Sean on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you and KBOO for a wonderful conversation. That was amazing.
Thank you.
My contribution would be that I think we need to have an honest appraisal of the possibilities of the American people rising up, and I would simply contend, along with William Moore, the author of Dark Ages of America, that the American people just don't have what it takes. Let's be honest about this. We've had a class consciousness lobotomy thanks to the Red Scare, McCarthyism, and COINTELPRO. Most people's minds are chock full of end-timer prophecy, Horatio Alger stories of entrepreneurialism. We're going to have to look outside the United States. We're going to have to look to South America. We're going to have to look to Central America because, sadly, and I'm sad that this is the case, the American people just don't have what it takes. They're not you know, historically, they're doomed. Let's put it that way.
Well, I hope that there's a way to waken us up, because I'm not sure that people would have thought the American people would have had what it took in the 30s, and certainly there were just incredible social uprisings and movements in the 30s, which really shaped a lot of the policies that came out of the Roosevelt administration. So a lot of people keep talking. I mean, I've had so many guests who were saying basically it's up to us, but I think it means it's up to those of us who are awakened to really go out there and do the work of waking up the rest of the American people. But I do agree with you that looking towards South America and Central America is very good motivation. If we can really educate our fellow North Americans about what's really happening in South America and what kinds of incredible social awareness there is among the populations there. And I know when I was in Venezuela 3 years ago, just the level of political discussion you have with people on the street was so much higher than it is in Norte America. But it's but I think that these are lessons that we can learn, and I think it's very important we don't just give up on North Americans, but we really struggle to wake up our country and to put us back on a better track.
Of course, you know, I'd like to agree with you, but, you know, the 20s and 30s, people were class conscious. The material realities of their lives dictated that they be class conscious.
I think that's what's happening again. I think the material reality of people's lives are probably dictating that they're going to become class conscious. I think some of the outrage about the AIG bonuses is an example of that. The book I think somebody was trying to remember is Dark Ages America by Morris Berman.
Exactly.
Okay,
right.
Great. Well, thanks a whole lot for calling.
Thank you very much.
And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We've got about another 10 minutes left of the show, and we're talking this morning about the outrages of the AIG bonuses, and that's a reflection of what else is wrong with the financial systems here, and how we as citizens and hopefully as people of a nascent movement can push the Obama administration away from the, as William Grider calls it, the monopoly game for the wealthy, for the wealthy financier wizards, and push the administration towards really taking care of the rest of us. Before we take our next caller, I just want to let you know that coming up on KBOO this morning at 9 o'clock on Alternative Radio, the topic is Freeing Tibet. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, financial analyst Catherine Austin Fitz analyzes the Treasury Department's plan for the economy. And Abu Nima talks about Gaza and the possibility of freedom and justice for Palestinians. At 11, on the Recovery Zone, the topic is the Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy. The topic is a Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy, which aims to build a local renewable energy system based at the Sunnyside Environmental School. At 11:30, we hear about the project Power Leap. They developed a flooring system that harnesses the kinetic energy of human motion and uses it to generate electricity. And right now we're talking about another kind of energy, that is financial energy, and how we sort of reclaim it into the hands of the people as opposed to the same banking giants who are controlling things and have been for so many decades. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. We got Robert on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. This is Robert, and you had a gentleman on there, a caller, saying basically he was worried about the people making minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as I can understand, this is the problem for what the banks did, that maybe Bernie Sanders was part of the forcing banks to sell houses to the people that were making minimum wage.
I think that's sort of distortion of what really went on. And no, it was actually the Bush administration that was really pushing for the great ownership society, and had a lot to do with helping the allowing the financial industry to come up with these really amazing instruments that on these mortgages where you didn't have very much of a down payment or none at all. And there's a movement of the right that tries to blame this on the Democrats, but in fact, I would say that had a lot more to do with a lot of the deregulation that happened in the last 8 years. I would say that some of it had to do with deregulation that happened under Clinton as well. Alan Greenspan had a great deal to do with it, and actually Ben Bernanke to some degree, and creating a debtor society, which is what was really the motivations of what was driving the economy under the Clinton administration to some degree, but particularly in the last 8 years under Bush. So that's my thoughts about that.
You figure it's Bush's responsibility.
A lot. I mean, not totally. No, because I would say a lot of it is
right.
Alan Greenspan's responsibility. He was the one who really pushed deregulation, and this was under Reagan and the first Bush. And I hold Bill Clinton responsible for not getting rid of Alan Greenspan, instead embracing those policies and having Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, who were these great free market deregulators, who were kind of neoliberal. Centrist Democrat deregulators who believed in this kind of ways of making the market grow. And so we saw this incredible financial bubble that was created under Clinton, and the economy was like expanding beyond the outer limits of the universe. However, it was based on basically a debtor society, and it was based on these kinds of instruments that have imploded since. But George Bush went and kind of did deregulation heaven, and just kind of, I think, drove the last nails into the coffin of any sanity in our financial policy. So we're really, the last 8 years of financial deregulation are really what have created the mess that we're in right now.
Yeah, well, let me say this, dear, and he's, Barney Frank is not a Republican, and he's the one, it was even on the TV that they were on the radio that there was nothing wrong with these people. I mean, right? Isn't that what he said?
Nothing wrong with what people?
The people that were AIG or whoever it is when they were giving out the loans.
I don't think that that's exactly the case. Barney Frank has actually been very big on re-regulating. He's been part of the Democratic Party. He's been really pushing for stronger regulations and have been pushing for a really long time. And Barney Frank has been in the forefront of that. So
yeah,
I don't know. We really need to continue this conversation. Anyway, thanks a whole lot for calling.
Yeah, you bet.
And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We've got about another 5 minutes left here on Locus Focus. We have Jordan on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Pretty good.
Hey, I've just been listening. Great show. And it seems like now there can be a backlash, a public backlash on AIG. And if we can get our president to show a little backbone and make some changes that will actually benefit all of us instead of the rich, wealthy class, he might be able to pass the acid test within the first 100 days.
How do you think we should do that?
We need entitlement reform. We need to have, there's a huge permaculture and nonprofit community here in Portland that they've been here for decades, and they can help support build the bottom layer of what's going to be an equitable society.
See, I hear that, but what I'm wondering is how do we get from that, from the grassroots up to the presidency, and how do we make the presidency responsive to a lot of things that we know very well, coming from the grassroots here on the ground in a place like Portland?
I guess the information would have to come from somebody who knows of the nonprofits and who knows which niche could be immediately filled, like, say, 500 new community gardens in Portland for the year 2009. It's one thing, but the quicker we start to know each other and, share resources with each other and start to trust each other, a lot of other things that, a lot of fears that have been pounded into our head for, 30, 40, maybe even longer, a lot of those will go away. We can, if you know people in your community, you don't have to worry about security issues. And if you trust the businesses that are in your community, you don't have anything, you don't have the graft happens that, like, AIG and the banks. These guys... The people who have received bailout money should actually be fired. They should be interviewed. It's like, what were you thinking? And now, I don't know. I mean, it seems like it didn't happen at all in the last 8 years. And finally, now we woke up on November 4th and we want change. And now I love what people are talking about. I hate that it's called populism because it's something that stupid people in mainstream media can talk about.
Well, populism is kind of like a put down. I mean, there are parts of populism that are sort of have a great American resonance, but populism is usually pretty much a derogatory term for saying the stupidity of the people. What do the people know? But there, populism often lapses into xenophobia and racism and hatred of the other and kind of a knee-jerk anti-government kind of mindset. So I think it's important that we sort of separate the strands of populism from some of the other deeper knowledge that, that is being really revealed as people's outrage comes. But I guess my question is, you know, there are amazing things happening here in Portland. I mean, you know, looking at the, what we're doing, talking about on KBOO coming up this rest of the morning, and at 11 o'clock we're talking about the Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy, which is a program at Sunnyside School. People are starting to figure out a way to generate electricity and heat for the very neighborhood around Sunnyside School, which is something that I've been like on the horn for years. That I, you know, it'd be really, really great if we could generate our own local energy and we weren't beholden to the big power companies. And so there's things like this are happening in Portland, and I think it's happening in little communities around the country. But the question is, how do we connect all of this so that it has an impact nationally? And how do we? I mean, I'd like to connect to that wonderful vegetable garden that Michelle Obama is planting on the White House lawn. And I think that's an example of something really great coming out of the White House. But I'd like to see financial policies on the part of her husband's advisors coming out that match the kind of energy of that vegetable garden.
I think with the level that all the people in this country are now bringing it up, they're actually now beginning to talk, and it's been the most inspirational thing to hear. Just people who didn't talk years ago, they finally had enough. It's like the crisis and the graft has affected them. So now everybody, you know, from all walks of life and all different types of socioeconomic backgrounds and things are talking. Maybe this is how it's going to happen, and we'll start connecting, and we'll just have huge, there'll be huge movements, there'll be huge gatherings of people breaking ground on different gardens, breaking grounds on a new solar plant or a new solar manufacturer. We need to have some of this new sustainable technology infrastructure here in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay. Well, thanks a whole lot for calling.
Thank you very much.
And let's see if I have any more callers. We do. We're going to take one more caller. So Michael's on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. At the risk of sounding nihilistic, I work in the housing industry. I do hardwood floor sanding. And for years, I've been talking with customers and with friends of mine and coming to appointments with people who moved into houses, hundreds of them, who couldn't afford to do anything once they got in there, and it was pretty obvious to me that I didn't see how they were going to afford the house pretty soon. Most of the people that I was talking to, if not all, and friends, saw this coming for years. That's one point that I wanted to make. How did Floor Guy know, but these big people who are supposed to be doing everything, it's a surprise to them? It's like that scene in Casablanca when the police officer is suddenly surprised of gambling and then
right.
Someone hands him his winnings.
Right. I'm almost out of time, so we need to wrap this up.
Well, I have one question. What do you say to people who say, this is non-productive, talking about it is non-productive, they feel powerless? Like the caller you had a few minutes ago who said that the American people just don't have it in them. We have it in us. It's just been beaten out of us. We're to the point where everyone sort of feels like, what's the point in talking about it? What good would it do? And I need a response to that question, because I'm getting this from everybody that I'm talking to is they just get upset with me instead of upset with what they're supposed to be upset about, and don't want to really look at it, so they're in denial.
I say, to have them watch The Daily Show. Actually, John Stewart has been doing the best analysis of what's going on in the financial world of anybody I've seen, and he's very funny, and he explains it in a way that I think people really get it. And so I would say, put them onto The Daily Show. Maybe that through humor they can start to understand just how serious the problem is and also realize that they can be empowered. So, and with that, I have to actually get out of here. So,
okay.
Thanks a whole lot for calling. I just want to let people know that there's a couple of things coming up next week that two events that I find very interesting. One is a screening of a film called Arid Lands. It's the internationally acclaimed documentary about the land and people of the Columbia River Basin in eastern Washington. It's also home to the Hanford nuclear site, the largest environmental cleanup in history. It's a land of incredible contradictions. Coyotes roam among reactors. Salmon spawn in the middle of golf courses, and federal dollars spur rapid expansion. The movie showing Monday, March 30th, between 7 and 9:30 at the First Unitarian Church, Elliott Chapel, Southwest 12th and Main. And then the next night, also sponsored by the the First Unitarian Church, and this is also a fundraising event for KBOO, is a presentation by author Andrew Nikovorek on tar sands, dirty oil, and the future of a continent. And it's at the First Unitarian Church again, Southwest 12th and Main, between 7 and 9 p.m. Two very interesting topics and very interesting, fine film and a very interesting speaker. I've heard Andrew Nikovorek on the radio, and he has an awful lot to say about a very scary process that is taking us far away from a sustainable future. Anyway, I want to thank you for listening and calling. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I'll be back next week, and maybe we'll be talking about tar sands next week. I'm inspired as I saw this, this little flyer. We're going to go out with some music by the other Robert Johnson about hard times. Stay tuned for Alternative Radio coming up after the hour.
Around for my shoes, her bag I did. Oh, walking through a walk this morning, here around for my shoes. But you know about it, I did. Oh, walking through.
Oh, greetings, Cascadia. My name is Steve, and this is the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. The Bread and Roses Center is hosting a public roundtable discussion tonight on the topic of nationalizing our banking system. Can Obama really do this? How can workers get controlling interest in these financial institutions? Find out what nationalization of the banks means and brainstorm ideas towards achieving worker control over the banks. Bring your questions and opinions to the Bread and Roses Center tonight at 6:30 p.m. That's at 819 North Killingsworth on bus lines 4 and 72. Come on down to the Red and Black Cafe for Spokes Pizza Night, a benefit show for the RNC 8. Portland dance meister J.D. starts spinning discs at 7 p.m. and will continue making music until forced off the turntables in the wee hours of the morning. Stuff your face with homemade vegan pizza. That's tonight at the Red and Black Cafe at Southeast 12th and Oak. Please join the Cinema Project in welcoming British artist and filmmaker Ben Rivers to Portland for a fantastic survey of his 16mm films. This program marks the first in a series called Beyond Borders, which focuses on international visiting artists. The screening will take place tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. at the Cinema Project, 11 Northwest 13th Avenue on the fourth floor. We'll be showing 11 of his favorite shorts. For more information, see www.cinemaproject.org. This has been the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. Thanks for listening. You can read this calendar entry online at www.kboo.fm/communitycalendar. If you support full-strength, volunteer-powered, homegrown community radio, then browse on over to www.kboo.fm and click Join Now.
And yes, you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. It is 1 minute, almost 2 minutes past 9 a.m. And coming up this morning is Alternative Radio. The guest is Tenzin Tsundu, a Tibetan freedom activist. He talks about freeing Tibet. At 11 is Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. That was at 10 is Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, financial analyst Catherine Austin Fitz analyzes the Treasury Department's plan for the economy. And Ali Abu Nima talks about Gaza and the possibility of freedom and justice for Palestinians. At 11 on the Recovery Zone, the featured guests are John Sorensen and Seth Truby, co-founders of Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy, which aims to build a local renewable energy system based at the Sunnyside Environmental School. At 11:30, Todd Wilson speaks with Elizabeth Redmond about Project Power Leap. They developed a flooring system that harnesses the kinetic energy of human motion and uses it to generate electricity. And so now we're going to go to Alternative Radio.
In the interest of China and in the interest of immediate danger that is happening in Tibet, His Holiness said, we want autonomy. so that Tibet didn't have to be separated as an independent country, as it was. Now, if China is not interested in that, we will start to work for an independent Tibet. So therefore, our struggle is going to be much more confrontational, aggressive. At the same time, all of us agreed, 100% nonviolence.
That's Tenzin Tsundu, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Tenzin Tsundu on Free Tibet. Tibet is the inspiration behind the idea of Shangri-La, paradise on earth. Scholars can debate the veracity of that. But today, Tibet, in the words of the Dalai Lama, its spiritual leader, is hell on earth. And these 50 years of Chinese occupation have brought untold suffering and destruction to the land and people of Tibet. Today, the religion, culture, language, and identity, which successive generations of Tibetans have considered more precious than their lives, are nearing extinction. The Nobel Peace Prize winners spoke on March 10, 2009, in Dharamsala, India, the Himalayan hill town that is the seat of the Tibetan government in exile. Tibetans outside of China and their supporters held rallies around the world to mark the 50th anniversary of the failed revolt against Chinese rule. The Chinese military crushed the rebellion, forcing the Dalai Lama to flee across the mountains to India. A new generation of Tibetans are using modes of action and resistance which draw on techniques and examples from the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, the Gandhi-led Indian Freedom Movement, and the Rukka Society. Prominent in the new activism is Tenzin Tsundu. Tenzin Tsundu is a poet, writer, author, and noted activist for Tibetan freedom. He's widely regarded as a leading voice of the Tibetan exile community. His daring actions, which you'll hear about in a few minutes, capture the imagination of many around the world. Tsundu wears a red bandana around his head, which he vows he won't take off until Tibet is free. He had the bandana on when I talked with him at the offices of the Human Rights Law Network in New Delhi in early January 2009. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
2009 marks two anniversaries. One is the 60th anniversary of the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1949, and the 50th anniversary of the flight of the Dalai Lama from Tibet to India. What is the current situation inside Tibet?
After 60 years of Chinese invasion of Tibet, China has used all its ways and means to gain a strong, complete control of Tibet. They have used military, police, and most effectively the law to maintain their control. More than the control of Tibet, Chinese control in the colonial occupation of East Turkestan, Inner Mongolia, Manchuria, Tibet, and then present the idea of the Republic of the People's Republic of China that started in 1949. I think China today is at a crossroad. Will this republic really work, or are we just, you know, fooling ourselves? This is what the Chinese leadership are seriously thinking today, because this is a legacy that they have inherited from Mao Zedong. And Mao's idea has gone, but Mao, the image is living, and therefore picture of Mao still hangs in Tiananmen Square, but Mao's ideology, his strategy, everything's finished. But what has remained behind is the People's Republic of China, the fake nation based on former Soviet Union's republic model is still there, and therefore Tibet is a part of that larger problem of China. So therefore, when we are looking at the 60 years of Chinese invasion of Tibet,
we are wondering what's happening. And not so much to do with the anniversaries, because the Tibetans didn't wait for the 50th year of Dalai Lama's exile into India, or the 60 years of Chinese invasion, which is 2009. They burst out last year in an uprising. So maybe the Tibetan nature of resistance is not much to do with anniversaries, but they have their own ways of doing it. And then, you know, the public strategies that outburst last year when China was in most need of a good PR. So
because of the Olympics.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the Tibetans inside Tibet, they rose up in an uprising and busted the Chinese PR balloon. And that was very strongly supported, backed by the Tibetans living in international communities. And, you know, people all over the world, you know, there was a support for that. So a conclusion can be, you know, China won the maximum number of gold medals. China has overawed the international community with its organized, almost kind of in a military system, the Olympics. But half the world went to Tibet.
The heart of the world went to Tibet.
That's it. The heart of the world. Yeah. You know, people loved Tibet. And we have made a mark last year in 2008.
Now, that uprising was severely crushed by the Chinese military. There were killings, disappearances, detentions. People are being held. Nobody knows where they are. For example, I was just reading on the website of the International Campaign for Tibet about a woman in her 30s, Nortsin Wangmo. She was sentenced to 5 years in prison for just talking on the telephone and sending email messages on the internet about the situation inside of Tibet. Her whereabouts are unknown today.
Yes, she's one such case. Now, there are thousands of people who are in jail today. Hundreds of people are still missing, especially young people who have been migrating for jobs or for education opportunities, either towards China from Tibet, or people who travel within Tibet from Kham and Amdo into Lhasa area, or maybe educated Tibetans from Lhasa maybe going to some places in Amdo or in Kham. Public mobility is it's hugely controlled. And the government comes out with weird kind of reasons to stop them, not allowing, permissions not granted. The government has today completely controlled people's movement, communication, transportation facilities there, but people cannot move. And all in the name of maintaining stability and unity of the country. And therefore, go on with this propaganda, this thing that we have to resist foreign intervention. And the Dalai clique and people like us doing something. But what can we do? It is the people in Tibet who are not happy with the Chinese invasion and the continued occupation of Tibet. And therefore, people like Nunzin, they are having to, you know, live with such harsh reality. And I know for us Tibetans living in exile, they are our inspiration. You know, we follow them. We have such high respects of their, you know, the courage, the sacrifice, and we look up to them. And we remind ourselves that we may be in free country, but our country is not free. Our people are fighting. And this is the message that I go about spreading all around in the Tibetan community, that, you know, we have to take lessons, the examples of our people who are there in Tibet, who are resisting the Chinese invasion in front of the guns.
Talk about the importance of the Dalai Lama. What role does he play in Tibetan cultural and political and spiritual life?
His Holiness the Dalai Lama is not only respected but worshipped as a Buddha. And so for the Tibetans, he's the incarnation of the Buddha of love and compassion, the Avalokiteshvara. In Tibetan we say Chenrezig. And even with the younger generation Tibetans like us, we have such high respect and worship in him that it's very difficult to even come out with your own opinion, if at all there is something. And it's not that we would want to say anything against him or that is different from him. We would continue to think that there may be something which I don't understand. There may be my political education, there may be a limitation. And therefore, when His Holiness says that we will look for an autonomous arrangement with People's Republic of China and find a negotiated solution, we all would like to be with him and agree with him and find a possibility there. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the spirit of today's Tibet, is the symbol, is the leader, is a spiritual as well as the political leader. And I think yes, His Holiness has nurtured a very deep sense of democracy in the Tibetan community. You know, starting from the very the invitation and the introduction of democracy in the Tibetan community from 1960 onwards up to now, he single-handedly nurtured this. And even he himself resisted many traditional notions of leadership and did away with many of the policies which would have reserved the power only in His Holiness. So His Holiness has even encouraged the Prime Minister to take more leadership. And I think this is going to be the process. In future, we're going to have a Prime Minister who will be much more powerful than he is today. And His Holiness will have less political power. I should say that the Prime Minister will have more power, and His Holiness will, I think, continue to be both the spiritual as well as the political leader. With the political stand, I think here's the difference that is coming about. Among the younger generation Tibetans, a lot of Tibetans, youngsters, are saying, well, we respect your Holiness, but there may be certain political pressure on you, and because of which you are having to choose the middle path policy, looking for autonomy. And because independence, what we say in Tibetan, Rangzin, is there in every Tibetan's heart. It's not that Tibetans do not want independence and therefore we seek autonomy. But because it is His Holiness's wish, we are continuing. So therefore sometimes it feels, many Tibetans, even though it is independence that is in their heart, they may be having to choose autonomy because they, out of respect and also believe in His Holiness. So therefore there are people like us who say, you know, we want independence and this is a difference of opinion, and let that be. And let this be the true color of our democracy.
But I'm interested that, you know, the Dalai Lama has said that this is the worst period in our 2,000-year history. In early December, he went to Brussels to speak before the European Parliament, and he talked about the very grim situation inside Tibet, and he went on to say, Tibetans face a death sentence, a sentence aimed at wiping out the spirit of the Tibetan people. Now, if he is saying that, and if that is his assessment of the crisis in Tibet, how can he maintain this position of wanting to achieve some kind of autonomy?
Well, I think I completely understand His Holiness's grave concern of the situation that is prevailing in Tibet. When we usually talk about Guantanamo Bay, this thing, and the prisons in Iraq and various other things, these are the images that we are able to see. But the situation in Tibet is far, far worse. Things, even if we say, even if the political prisoners talk about, people refuse to believe. because there is no direct image, a photograph or a video of it. And situation in Guantanamo and places in Iraq, which everybody in the world are today, you know, bombarded with these kind of images. But that's nothing. Really, I'm comparing this to the death, torture, people missing, and the way people are being treated in Tibet. Absolutely inhuman. So therefore, His Holiness is concerning. And here he's not talking even about the death and the torture in prison. Here he's talking on the larger picture of Tibet, where Chinese population influx in Tibet is happening at such a high rate that we feel that Tibet is going to be flooded by Chinese population. And this is a tactic many of the colonial empires have always done. Flood the local population with your population and completely flatten the difference, the cultural difference, people's ways of living, and homogenize. And then say, we are one country, we are united. In the name of unity of a nation, we should have people working together. And this is what China always loves to say, that we need to help the Tibetan natives who have no knowledge of science and technology, and our youngsters, you know, who they meant the unemployed, jobless graduates in the hinterlands of China. They wanted them, they are encouraging them to go to Tibet and start small cyber cafes and get into information business, and also start Chinese takeaway restaurants on the roadsides, and karaoke bars. These are things that this Chinese government want their people to do in Tibet in the name of developing the local economy. And therefore Tibet is in danger. Chinese population influx is happening, and we are seeing right in front of us what happened to Inner Mongolia. 85% of Inner Mongolia's population today are Han Chinese, and perhaps if at all there is a miracle. Otherwise, the Han Chinese population have completely flooded Inner Mongolia, and Inner Mongolians may never be able to rise up. Look at Manchuria. Manchuria is finished. They may not be an independent Manchuria tomorrow. So this is what is going to happen in Tibet if we do not work now.
In the 1950s, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States was actively aiding the Tibetan resistance. In fact, I read somewhere that in my home state of Colorado, Tibetans were brought to be trained. But then the CIA and the United States abandoned Tibet. Why?
Well, I should like to correct your language. They were not aiding the Tibetans. They were using the Tibetans.
Okay.
You know, they were fearing that if Chinese occupation of Tibet was successful, then after Tibet and East Turkestan, China's colonial empire would be spreading towards the West, and which would get connected to the former Soviet Union's communist bloc. So this could become a huge communist bloc from Japan right up to the doors of Europe. You know, this is something, you know, America was fearing. America was frightened that this communist bloc happens. This will be a biggest challenge for America. So America wanted to have an intervention where possible, and they saw that the Tibetans were fighting the Chinese. They were resisting the Chinese invasion. So they came in using Dalai Lama's elder brother, who thought, I don't know really whether he was really aware of American vested interest, but he did take American military and arms, ammunition, training, and you know, with that he used it through the Tibetan armed armed resistance and for the Chinese. And this went on for quite some time, and there were Tibetans who used to be taken away from Tibet, trained in I heard that it was in Hawaii Island. I also heard that it was in Colorado area, and they were later dropped in Tibetan land, and they were to have better understanding of military tactics, American military tactics. But I don't know how useful it was, because the Tibetan whole topography was different. The ways of Tibetan traditional fighting was very different. They were cavalry, horse-mounted Tibetan fighters who were using local tactics, strategies to fight the Chinese, living in the mountains, coming down into the, into the valleys when they see that an attack is possible. So they were attacking and looting the Chinese small camps and taking away the arms and ammunition, then fighting them from another angle. So that kind of guerrilla warfare was going on. So this is where the Tibetans used the American arms and ammunition and certain other things. But the moment America found that Chinese nature of communism and Soviet was different, so therefore they can never be together, they immediately went to Beijing, shook hands with Chinese leadership, Nixon and all these people went, and they found friendship with them, and then Tibetans were dropped suddenly. And this itself, because by then the Tibetans and the Americans had built a rapport and a way of fighting. So many of the Tibetans who were up there in the mountains waiting for reinforcement, many of them actually died up there in the mountains, because suddenly there was a cut in the reinforcement. So and then a lot of things couldn't be worked in that way. So the this was one reason why the whole armed resistance suddenly collapsed in 1973-74.
And today, China is America's number one trading partner.
Absolutely. I see if China stopped making bras and panties, America would go naked tomorrow. I mean, this is the kind of a relationship. So, and again, America, makes it very easy. Say, America blames China for creating this Darfur crisis. America is concerned only about Darfur crisis as the biggest case of human rights violation, And America blames China because America says that China is supporting the military regime there because China has interest of oil in Sudan, and therefore China is giving the military regime in Sudan money and arms. If America can blame China for having created this, I want to blame America and all other Western countries for trading with China and strengthening their military control in Tibet, East Turkestan, Inner Mongolia, Manchuria, and also suppressing the freedom movement within China. Chinese people who want labor rights, Chinese people who want free press, Chinese people who want democracy, Chinese people who want right to religion, who want to practice Falun Gong and various other, even Catholics. Chinese Catholics are persecuted in China. And China has no ideological problem with Falun Gong or Catholics or Buddhists, or even the Tibetan Buddhists. The problem is not ideological. The problem is congregation. When a lot of people come together for certain religious practice or anything, they fear this congregation could become a public movement. This is their fear. They are paranoid about public gathering. They do not want any of public gathering. Even during the earthquake, when people were helping each other, the military was more concerned about public gathering. So, you see, the nexus of trade, America and China and all other Western countries, including Australia, they trade with China, and they make money out of what the Hu Jintao and the gang. Hu Jintao is selling Chinese people as cheap slave labor, and America and everybody else, they are patronizing, making money. So the corporates and these Western countries make money out of the backs of the cheap slave labor. But you should be responsible in where your money is going, where you are spending, and who are you buying. And America is very much aware of all the slave labor there, or all the sweatshops in China. So all these Western countries are aware. And what I'm not able to understand is, why are there not enough journalists reporting the sweatshops and how in ordinary people, Chinese people, maybe 200 million Chinese may be making the face of good and developing China, but the 800 million Chinese are the people who are really suffering. They are being taken advantage of, and they're being cheated. They are today victims of the Chinese government, People's Republic of China, which runs in the name of communism. But it's the perhaps the biggest capitalist factory in the world. So I really want to speak to all the Western countries, people who live there, to be more aware of this and take notice of this and be responsible of your money. You know, maybe this is something we can start with. We are not saying that you go and topple the Chinese government, but at least we can start having put pressure on the Chinese government to have a fair relationship. Maybe the American government could send fact-finding delegations to see the nature of the Chinese labor.
Now, in 1997, you were teaching in the border region of India and Tibet, and you decided to take a special journey.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Well, that was kind of a very personal journey for me, yes. From childhood, I'm a Tibetan born and brought up in India. My parents came from Tibet. But Tibet was something that had always been there, a part of my upbringing, my realization, my growing up years, was there in the stories, in the games, the stories that our parents, grandparents used to tell us. So Tibet had always been there in our psyche, in our basic existence. So when we hear of Tibet, we always heard of Tibet as a beautiful land. And my grandparents used to say, and this is the image of Tibet that remains stuck with me, been my imagination of Tibet. It's a green, huge pasture land, and there in the middle of it there are nomads singing, grazing their yaks and sheep, dressed in colorful chuba. And singing, that kind of imagination of Tibet was there. And then with my education in school and later in college, it was completely shattered. In 1987, when I was in 7th standard in school, there were two Americans, John Arkley and Dr. Blake Kirk. Those two people, they were in Tibet in 87 when the protests in Tibet started in 1987, which continued in 88, 89, 90, right up to 93. They brought us images of protests in Tibet, Chinese military shooting Tibetans in the middle of the street, monks getting shot to death, and they've been brought clothes of bullet marks and then blood stains on them. This completely shocked and changed my whole imagination of Tibet. It was right there, practical, right there in front of me. So I always wanted to be in Tibet. And even today I feel that I should have been born in Tibet rather than in India. I would want to be there in the place of action, where there is struggle, where there is resistance.
You're listening to Tenzin Sundu on Free Tibet. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So I wanted to go there. So after my graduation, I did my graduation English literature from South India, Madras, Loyola College. And then after that, I went to Ladakh, taught in a Tibetan school English for 1 year, and then I went to Tibet. So for me, leaving behind my life in India and going to Tibet, join the freedom struggle. So perhaps when I look back on this, it was more like a romantic dream of a young college graduate. So I didn't inform anybody. I just went up to the border somehow, learning how to go there. And from the border, I just walked. It's a very poetic moment. It was just literal walk to Tibet. And nobody stopped me. I didn't see anybody there. I just created a situation where I was able to go right up to the border and walk to Tibet. And I found myself in Tibet. And this was 1997, March the 4th. I was crossing, and I was to meet some businessmen on the other side of the border, Tibetan businessmen, because there's a close relationship between the Tibetan businessmen on the Tibet side and on the India side in winter. But by the time I reached there, I was late. The business had been wound up, had gone home, and I was lost in the mountains. And it's like really high altitude, cold, and blizzard. I got lost. For 5 days, I just walked on my own with no food, surviving. The whole river, Indus River, was frozen. I was chipping at the edges of the river with a stone and quenching my thirst with that. And I lived on that for 5 days. It was really difficult for me. My lips cracked. It was bleeding, completely exhausted. But somehow I survived. I just said to myself, I just cannot die there. I've come to Tibet. And it was really difficult for me to make the negotiation. I've come to my dreamland and I'm dying. It was exhausting. Nobody there. And the first man that I met, a nomad, helped me from the collar when I was collapsing on my feet. There was this emotional moment of seeing a human being after 5 days of getting lost in the mountains. You see this human being and you ask for help, for water, and this man grabbed me from the collar and said, "You are a loafer. You have come from outside with an intention. So show me your weapons. What do you have?" And he started to search my pockets and things. So this completely shocked me. And there was no sympathy. There was no compassion in the man. And there was nothing. It didn't touch him that a man is falling on his knees with no energy in his body left. And this really shocked me. How can a human being be so brutal? He was a Tibetan. But of course, later I learned that he was working for the military. There are many nomads who have been employed by the Chinese military to do their grazing of sheep, at the same time watch the border. And later he handed me over to the military. And he must have, won some award or something. But that's how I got entangled in the whole legal system. I got arrested. I was in prison. I was beaten up, interrogated by 15 different people from all different points, from intelligence, from military, all different backgrounds. I had a harrowing time. 12 days in Western Tibet in prison, and later when they were not happy with this, I said, I've come here for free Tibet. But only thing is, I came alone. I have no weapon or no support or nothing. And they couldn't believe that a young man, a graduate, which is like 15 years of education in India, had come to Tibet with no support. They couldn't believe. So they took me to Lhasa. And I was in Lhasa prison for 3 months. There's a place called Situ Detention Camp. I was there throughout March, April, May. Very, very difficult time. More than any physical brutality or getting beaten up, for me, the most troublesome, what was really troubling me, was to live in uncertainty in the mercy of your controller. You don't know what's going to happen to you this morning, this afternoon, or this evening. And randomly they would call me, you know, make me sit on a small bench, and they would sit at the table with three, four people asking me different questions, and then writing, making notes, and they'd say, we'll call you later. You know, that kind of thing. It was really fearsome. And having been accustomed to living in freedom and in India, you know, I love India's freedom. And with that, having so accustomed to college life and freedom, and suddenly I'm in jail in that kind of extreme situation, condition of control, and a situation where I'm completely helpless. I'm completely vulnerable. Anything could happen to me, and yet nobody in the world would know. You know, this was traumatizing. But, you know, this was nothing, you know, compared to the next room neighbor. My neighbor prisoner, his name is Dawa Gelsen. He was arrested for putting our Free Tibet posters. And because he asked his younger brother and his younger brother's friends to put our poster in the street, he was arrested. And the charge was masterminding. He was a mastermind. You know, making Free Tibet posters and putting them up in the street. He was arrested. And he was in jail. By the time I'd been in jail, he was already in jail for 1 year, 2 months. And in May, that day, May 20th, no, May 14th, May 14th, 1997, he was released. I was also released. He was released in the morning, I was released in the night. And after that, I was thrown out of Tibet. I came to India. I was in Bombay for my university education. And in year 2000, I met a political prisoner from Tibet. I told him my story. And I said to him the details of Dawa Gelsen. And he said, Dawa Gelsen was never released. He was transferred from Sidhu detention camp to Trapchi prison. And now Trapchi is the most notorious prison, biggest prison for political prisoners. And I learned that he was imprisoned, sentenced for 18 years for masterminding Free Tibet posters. And yet the resistance goes on. Now if these kind of political prisoners today, if they agreed, okay, now I give up, I agree with whatever you say, I will not do Free Tibet, I'll keep Free Tibet out of mind, they'll be released. But these people do not. They hold on to the principle. And therefore, for me, these political prisoners, all of them, are my heroes. Principled, strong at heart, strong built. And these are the people who give freedom to others. Because of their work, tomorrow the future generation of Tibetans will live in a free Tibet.
In the November 26th terror attacks on Mumbai, a certain hotel was in the news, not just the Taj Hotel, but the Oberoi. You had an experience there in 2002 when you decided to launch a unique protest when the Prime Minister of China was visiting. What did you do?
Well, that was in 2002. Chinese Prime Minister Zhu Rongji was visiting India, and he was coming to Bombay. He was having a business conference in it used to be called the Oberoi Towers. It's now called the Trident, that tall tower. It's 30 floor high hotel building. He was there, he was giving a talk, and I had climbed up the building, climbing the scaffoldings. The building was under repair. There was some kind of cementing on the facade. So they were having scaffoldings up the hotel facade from the ground floor right up to the top. And there were these huge lifts used by the laborer to go up and down carrying the cement and the colors. The lift had already gone up right to the top, And I had climbed that scaffolding from the ground floor to the 14th floor, and I displayed a Free Tibet banner, a red banner with Free Tibet painted in white. And I was carrying a Tibetan national flag. I had climbed up to the 14th floor, and it happened that at the 14th floor, inside, the Chinese Prime Minister was giving a lecture in the business conference. And due to the media attention from the crowd, there was a huge traffic jam on the ground because everybody started to look up, and it was there on live on TV. Their business got disturbed, and many of the Chinese came out into the room adjacent to where I was standing outside, and they were looking at me. There were these Chinese who were at the window. They didn't seem to be angry. They were more surprised, flabbergasted that somebody could climb up the scaffolding and do a Free Tibet poster. That's what happened. But I'm really sad that the same place was used by terrorists. People can have grievances, difference of opinion. You can protest. But I'm not happy with terrorism at all. Whether it's individual terrorism or group terrorism or even state terrorism. I protest any kind of violent activities like this. Killing people, taking other people's lives, taking other people's freedom. You know, I am not happy with Chinese occupation of Tibet. I'm going to protest. I have protested, and I will protest more. But I'm not willing to take other people's lives. I'm not willing to take other people's freedom just because I want freedom. And I respect the Chinese people. I respect the Chinese religion, culture. And I have a vision that Chinese and the Tibetans can live together as neighbors, respecting our religion and culture and borders. We can be friends as we were in history, but we are not willing to submit our freedom.
Now, you've written a book of stories and poems called Kora. What does Kora mean?
Kora is the idea of circumambulation. You go around a sacred element. It can be a stupa or a monastery or a lake or a sacred lake or a monk or a mountain like the Mount Kailash. So you go for a kora around that.
And among the poems you've written, one is called Refugee. I'd like you to read it.
Yes, this is a poem. Structurally, the poem has two titles: one to begin with, one to end with. And there is a conflict which I try to resolve. The poem has the title Refugee. Refugee. When I was born, my mother said, "You are a refugee." Our tent on the roadside smoked in the snow. On your forehead, between your eyebrows, there is an R embossed. My teacher said, I scratched and scrubbed. On my forehead, I found a brash of red paint. I have three tongues. The one that sings is my mother tongue. The R on my forehead, between my English and Hindi, the Tibetan tongue reads Rangzam. Freedom means Rangzam. So the first title is Refugee, and the end title is Rangzin, which is a Tibetan word for freedom.
And you have another poem about Dharamsala, where you live now.
Yes.
And which is the center of the exiled Tibetan community. There are about over 100,000 Tibetans in India.
Yes, in India, totally about 120,000 Tibetans live in India, and we have about 30,000 Tibetans living in America, Canada, Europe, Australia. And Dharamsala has a huge population, almost about 8,000 to 9,000 Tibetans. And this is the capital of Tibetans in exile. His Holiness Dalai Lama lives there. We have democratically run the exiled government. And we have centers of all the cultural institutes and also non-governmental organizations.
But also in Dharamsala, there was a very important meeting in late November 2008 to discuss the future of Tibet and what might be done. Were there any new important developments or any new proposals that people should know about?
Yes, I'm very happy with the very successful and meaningful meeting that we had in November. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been keeping his hope for an autonomous arrangement with the People's Republic of China for almost about 30 years now. And he's been hoping that maybe the Chinese government will talk to us, will find a negotiated solution. And therefore he's been sending delegations, one after another, and 8 delegations had gone to Beijing ever since there was a revival of this kind of relationship from 2002. But in 2008, when the uprising happened in Tibet, when people, long time keeping the dissension in mind, and when they protested, when they were not, when they were coming out into the street and openly saying that we are not happy with this policy, we want freedom, and it's not one place or two places or not a handful of people. No, Tibetans all over Tibet, all different places, thousands of Tibetans took part in this, even risking their own lives. And His Holiness says, instead of listening to the grievances of the people, complaints of the people, on trying to rectify these, the Chinese government violently clamped down on them and killing people. And hundreds of people are missing. Thousands of people are in jail today. And after doing all these things, they started to blame His Holiness for inciting such kind of protests. And therefore, His Holiness says that now I cannot leave this freedom struggle. So he wants people to make a decision. So therefore, he called this special meeting in Dharamsala. Towards the end of October, His Holiness started to say that his trust in the Chinese government is becoming thinner and thinner. And then the delegation, the 8th delegation, which went to China and came back, and they announced the failure of the dialogue process. And not only them, before they could say anything, Chinese government from Beijing called an international conference there, press conference, and they said, we have rejected the Tibetan memorandum, which they described as memorandum for semi-independence or covert independence. And our delegation was saying that this memorandum was for autonomy. So it's a huge difference of opinion there. And with this, then when the meeting happened from 17 to 22nd November, 560 people from 19 different countries, we decided that presently, for a time being, we will follow with the same middle way path policy, looking for autonomy. But with immediate effect, because the dialogue process failed, because the Chinese government did not reciprocated to our efforts in finding a negotiated solution, we will stop sending the delegation because it's of no use. And then we are saying that if the Chinese government continues to not responding to us, to our negotiated, to our efforts in finding a negotiated solution, then we will reinstate independence as the goal of the Tibetan struggle, or demand the right to self-determination. Now, the demand for the right of self-determination was not so much discussed. Largely, independence came up as the alternative. You will see a strange thing happening here, because usually people make a bigger demand first, and then they come down to the smaller demand. But in here, we make the demand for autonomy, it's been going on for all this time. Now we are saying we're going to go back to independence. So I think the difference is, when you say autonomy, you have to depend on China to give you autonomy. But when we say independence, you have to make the country independent by your own work. You are no longer now dependent on China. This is the basic ideological difference, basic difference in perspective and ways of working. So now we are going to say, in the interest of China and in the interest of immediate danger that is happening in Tibet, His Holiness said, we want autonomy. So that Tibet didn't have to be separated as an independent country, as it was. Now, if China is not interested in that, we will start to work for an independent Tibet. So therefore, our struggle is going to be much more confrontational, aggressive. At the same time, all of us agreed, 100% non-violence. And, you know, His Holiness said that if there is any difference of opinion in terms of political stand, there should be, because ours is a democracy. But there should be no difference in opinion or political stand in the principle of non-violence. There can be no compromise on that. So all of us are going to be non-violent, but we will confront China and we will make Tibet an independent country. So this is going to be a direction. So we said that within a short period of time, if China continues to fail to talk to us and finding a negotiated solution, we will reinstate independence as a goal of the struggle. Now we will decide what is that short period of time. And whenever we feel that China is not responding to us appropriately and to any substance, then we will demand independence.
And you're optimistic.
I'm very optimistic with this. I'm very happy with this, at least, because I'm not happy with the exile government's policy of, you know, being too dependent on, or almost to the point of begging for autonomy. And I've written very strongly on this. You know, we are compromising on independence, and still the exile government is telling the Tibetans and the Tibet supporters not to protest against China when Chinese leadership, when they come out to visit America or Europe or India. Now the exile government has withdrawn that policy, and not only that, now we are saying that we are going to demand independence. So this is going to be a future policy.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You were just listening to Tenzin Sundu on Free Tibet. I talked with him in New Delhi in early January 2009. Tenzin Sundu is a poet, writer, and a noted activist for Tibetan freedom. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. We offer AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. We regularly feature such voices as Michael Parenti, Vandana Shiva, Maud Barlow, Tariq Ali, Robert Fisk, Arundhati Roy, Noam Chomsky, and Howard Zinn. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR so you don't miss a single program, we offer CD, MP3, and printed transcript subscriptions, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Tenzin Sundu on Free Tibet, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with participants in a mass meeting in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in 1964, singing the anthem of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, We Shall Overcome. It is sometimes sung by Tibetans, too.
It's 1 minute before 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and coming right up will be Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. Stay tuned at 10:15 on Flashpoints. Financial analyst Catherine Austin Fitz analyzes the Treasury Department's plan for the economy, and Ali Abu Nima talks about Gaza and the possibility of freedom and justice for Palestinians. At 11 on the Recovery Zone, the featured guests are John Sorensen and Seth Truby, co-founders of Sunnyside Neighborhood Energy, which aims to build a local renewable energy system based at the Sunnyside Environmental School. And at 11:30, Todd Wilson speaks with Elizabeth Redmond about Project Power Leap. Now,